All right, strap in, everyone. We've got quite the deep dive ahead of us. You guys have sent us some pretty intense writing. It's like someone took every thought bouncing around in their head and just hit paste.
Yeah.
Our mission, if we choose to accept it, is to decode this raw, unfiltered text and see if we can pull out any, I don't know, core themes or insights. I think we're up for it.
Absolutely. I think what's striking here is how densely packed the ideas are. Even if they seem a little disjointed at first, it's like a raw, unfiltered lens into a very specific worldview.
Okay.
And I think by analyzing it closely, we might uncover some pretty valuable insights into, those anxieties that kind of simmer beneath the surface of contemporary life.
Okay, so let's dive in. One thing that jumps out right away is a wave of disillusionment.
Right.
And not just like a mild case of the Mondays.
Uh-huh.
This author seems profoundly cynical about, well, everything. Modern society, institutions, political movements, you name it. It's almost like they're searching for meaning in a world they see as inherently meaningless. And there's this one quote that really captures this feeling. They say, democracy is an outdated concept. Any society with an ends to itself is an ontological failure.
That's a really powerful statement. And it echoes a sentiment we're seeing more and more these days, this growing distrust of democratic systems,
right.
This sense that they're no longer serving the needs of the people. And it's important to clarify, I think, that ontological failure in this context refers to a perceived lack of like fundamental purpose or inherent value.
So it's not just about the mechanics of democracy not working. It's deeper than that.
Yeah.
This author seems to be questioning the entire, foundation of how we organize ourselves as a society. And this disillusionment, it's not just reserved for the political sphere.
Mm-hmm.
It bleeds into their views on interpersonal relationships too. Sometimes in a very jarring way. They write, the reason why kill yourself is the predominant fuck-off of the 21st century is not because it's supposed to anger, but to shame you. Because we all want it and don't want to admit it. I'll admit, that's a bit tough to swallow.
It's certainly provocative and uses incredibly harsh language. But let's try to unpack the underlying psychology here. This isn't simply about telling people to harm themselves.
Right.
It's about, I think, exposing a raw nerve of despair. This feeling that death is the only escape from a meaningless existence is, well, it's a theme that kind of reverberates throughout the writing. And I think it might be connected to this concept of enemy. Yeah. It's a sociological term coined by Emile Durkheim. It describes a sense of normlessness and disconnect from society's values.
I see.
And that can lead to feelings of, well, alienation and purposelessness, which we definitely see in the author's writing.
It makes sense. It's like they're so disillusioned with the world around them that even dark humor becomes a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
But it's not all doom and gloom. There are moments where the author's intellectual curiosity kind of shines through, even if it's expressed in a somewhat unconventional way.
Mm-hmm.
They seem particularly fascinated by historical and philosophical figures like Nietzsche, but often with a twist.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, they mention Nietzsche and then they say, I don't think this Nietzsche shit is working out very well.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great example of how the author kind of wrestled with these complex ideas while simultaneously rejecting or reinterpreting them to fit their own worldview. They're acknowledging this intellectual tradition, but questioning its applicability to their own experience of the world. And what's interesting is they're not just dismissing these thinkers outright. They are engaging with them, albeit in a very critical and often cynical way. It reminds me of this concept of reactive devaluation in psychology.
Reactive devaluation.
Yeah, where individuals automatically dismiss information or arguments coming from sources they perceive as, well, antagonistic.
So even in their rebellion against established thought, they're still engaging with it.
Yes.
They're not simply apathetic. They're actively searching for, a different way of understanding the world, even if it leads them down some pretty dark paths.
Hmm.
And this search for meaning, it extends beyond the realm of philosophy. It bleeds into their critique of modern culture and technology.
Yes. And that's where their critique of what they call, the new world becomes particularly interesting. It's almost as if they're arguing that, that everything has become commodified, leading to a sense of emptiness and meaninglessness. Even experiences like travel or connecting with nature have been they've been commodified for you, resulting in this kind of passive hedonism that leaves people feeling unfulfilled.
So it's like they're saying that even our attempts to escape the emptiness of modern life are ultimately futile. because everything has already been packaged and sold back to us.
Right.
They're pushing back against this idea that happiness can be achieved through consumption,
yeah,
whether it's material possessions or curated experiences.
And this critique of consumerism, it's a recurring theme in many philosophical and sociological critiques of modern society. Thinkers like Jean Baudrillard have argued that we live in a hyper-reality where simulated experiences have come to replace genuine human connection and meaning.
So they're not alone in feeling this sense of disillusionment and alienation.
No, not at all.
It's a sentiment that resonates with, I think, a lot of people who are grappling with the complexities of modern life.
Yeah.
And it's not just about material possessions.
Right.
They apply this same critique to the realm of ideas, arguing that even intellectual pursuits have become this kind of game where people adopt certain positions or viewpoints simply to fit in or gain social capital.
It's a really astute observation, and it highlights, I think, the author's anxieties around around authenticity in a world that's just so saturated with information and opinions. It raises important questions for all of us, like how do we navigate this landscape? How do we form genuine beliefs and values when we're constantly bombarded with these, I don't know, pre-packaged narratives and ideologies?
Like they're suggesting that we become so focused on performing our identities and curating our online personas that we've lost touch with any sense of a genuine self.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to a profound sense of alienation, disconnection. A feeling of being lost in a world that doesn't value authenticity.
Which brings us back to, I think, their overall sense of disillusionment.
Right.
And their often quite extreme reactions to it.
Yeah.
They seem to be arguing that this lack of genuine intellectual engagement, coupled with a culture of consumerism and instant gratification, has created a society where people are, well, they're simultaneously overstimulated and deeply unfulfilled.
It's like a constant hunger for meaning that can never be satiated.
A real feast of famine. Yeah. We're bombarded with information and distractions, but we're also starved for meaning and connection. And, you know, this creates, well, it creates fertile ground for cynicism, nihilism, even extremism.
Right.
When people feel lost and without purpose, they become more susceptible to ideologies that offer simple answers and a sense of belonging, even if those ideologies are, well, harmful or destructive.
It's like grasping at straws in the dark, hoping to find something, anything to hold on to.
Yes.
And unfortunately, sometimes that grasp leads to something dangerous.
Which is why I think understanding perspectives like this one is so important. Not to condone them, but to better understand the underlying societal issues that, well, that fuel them.
So it's less about agreeing or disagreeing with the author and more about trying to understand where they're coming from and what their perspective might tell us about the world we live in.
Precisely. It's about recognizing that even the most challenging voices can offer valuable insights if we're willing to listen carefully and engage critically.
All right, so let's dig a little deeper here. I want to look at some specific passages that highlight this struggle for meaning and connection. There are a few moments where the author grapples with the nature of consciousness, the meaning of existence. Mm-hmm. They pose these questions that seem both, I don't know, profound and kind of absurd at the same time.
Yeah.
For instance, they ask, does the hound have lungs so that it can breathe or so it can exist as itself?
It's a quirky question. Phrased in a rather unconventional way, but it touches upon this this really fundamental philosophical debate, the nature of being. Are we simply biological machines driven by instinct, or is there something more to human existence,
right,
a spark of consciousness that sets us apart? And it seems like this author is really grappling with that very question, and their frustration might stem from not finding a satisfying answer.
And it's not just a theoretical exploration. They seem to be genuinely struggling with this question themselves, wondering if there's any inherent meaning or purpose to life, especially in a world that feels increasingly artificial, disconnected. They even question the value of their own writing, asking, am I saying something? Which I think speaks to a deep sense of existential uncertainty.
Absolutely. And this this self-doubt and this existential angst, it's palpable throughout the text. The author seems to be, I don't know, desperately searching for a sense of purpose and authenticity in a world that feels increasingly hollow and superficial, yet they struggle to articulate this yearning in a way that resonates with others.
It's almost like they're trapped in their own head, wrestling with these big questions, while simultaneously pushing away anyone who might, you know, offer a lifeline. And this tension between seeking connection and pushing people away. It plays out in a lot of different ways throughout their writing.
Yes, and that's definitely a key theme that we'll explore further as we continue our deep dive. As we wrap up this first section, what stands out to you the most?
I'm struck by the contrast between the author's intellectual curiosity and their often crude and offensive language. It's like they're searching for something profound but struggling to express it in a way that's, I don't know, constructive or even palatable. What do you think is driving that disconnect?
That's a great question, and it's something we'll need to unpack further. But I suspect it's a complex interplay of, well, personal experiences, social influences, and a deep-seated frustration with the world they see around them. But to truly understand this disconnect, I think we need to delve deeper into the author's views on technology, relationships, and their vision of a new world. All topics we'll explore in the next part of our deep dive.
Okay, so we've kind of established that this author is, I don't know, grappling with some serious disillusionment, this yearning for meaning in a world they see as increasingly meaningless. But it's not all passive complaining. They actually propose some pretty unconventional solutions to the problems they see.
Right, yeah. There's this strong anti-establishment streak that runs throughout their writing, coupled with this desire for, radical change. They rail against institutions, political ideologies, even, seemingly harmless trends like the whole scene girl aesthetic, which they see as this, form of manufactured rebellion, just another way to fit in.
Yeah, it's fascinating because they seem to be aware of the irony that even attempts to rebel can become just another form of conformity.
Exactly.
Like they're trapped in this paradox, yearning for individuality in a system that commodifies everything, even rebellion itself.
And this paradox, I think, is really key to understanding their frustration. They're struggling with this tension between, wanting to belong and wanting to be unique, a struggle that's likely amplified by the constant pressure to, curate a perfect online persona. This might be why they use the term chud, which is, a derogatory term often associated with social awkwardness and inability to fit in. By labeling themselves this way, they may be expressing a sense of alienation from both mainstream culture and the very subcultures they seem to want to belong to.
So it's not just about rejecting the mainstream. It's about struggling to find any authentic connection, mm-hmm. even within alternative communities. And this sense of isolation, I think, seems to fuel their cynicism, leading them to lash out at the world in these very extreme ways.
Absolutely. And this feeling of being trapped, both physically and ideologically, while it's palpable in their writing, they see technology and consumerism as forces that, that further limit our choices, creating a world where we're constantly bombarded with distractions, but starved for genuine human connection.
They even go so far as to say any society with an ends to itself is an ontological failure.
Right.
Suggesting a deep-seated nihilism.
And that nihilism, this belief that life is inherently meaningless, it seems to be, at the root of their despair and their often violent and hateful rhetoric. It's like they've given up on the possibility of finding meaning in the existing world.
Right.
And are therefore drawn to these more extreme ideologies that promise radical change, even if it comes at a high cost.
It's like they're so disillusioned with the present that they're willing to embrace any vision of the future, no matter how destructive, as long as it offers a sense of purpose or belonging.
And this desperation for change is reflected in some of their more bizarre and disturbing proposals, like their idea for, global segregation based on, race, religion, and other arbitrary factors.
Yeah, that one was hard to read. It's clear they're searching for some kind of order, stability in a world they see as chaotic and fragmented.
But their proposed solution is, it's incredibly flawed and harmful. It's based on, on fear and exclusion, this desire to create a utopia through division rather than through, unity and understanding. And it points to this key tension, I think, in their thinking. They crave connection, but seek it through exclusion.
It's a tragic paradox.
Mm-hmm.
They're so focused on what separates them from others that they miss the opportunity to build bridges and find common ground.
And this tendency to focus on difference rather than similarity, it extends to their engagement with intellectual ideas as well.
You mean how they'll reference someone like Nietzsche and then say, I don't think this Nietzsche shit is working out very well?
Exactly.
It's almost like they're using these intellectual figures as, as props to validate their own pre-existing worldview rather than rather than genuinely engaging with their ideas in a nuanced way.
Exactly. They're cherry-picking concepts and quotes that support their own biases, ignoring the broader context or complexities of the original works.
It's like they're building a case for their own worldview rather than trying to understand the world as it is.
Right.
And this selective engagement with ideas, it can lead to a dangerous reinforcement of existing biases.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder of the importance of, well, of critical thinking and a willingness to engage with ideas in their entirety, not just in isolated fragments that support our own preconceived notions.
Okay, so let's talk about their views on politics. Mm. They seem to have this deep distrust of both the left and the right, mm-hmm. viewing them as, two sides of the same coin, both more interested in power than in actually helping people.
The cynicism towards the political system is a major theme in their writing. They believe that both sides are, they're engaged in this game of, manipulation.
Deception.
Offering empty promises and failing to address the real issues facing society.
They're particularly critical of what they call reformists.
Right.
People who are, trying to work within the system to bring about change. They seem to think that any attempt at incremental change is futile because the system itself is inherently corrupt.
And this rejection of incremental change, it's often a hallmark of, extremist ideologies. They believe mm-hmm. that the only solution is a complete overthrow of the existing system, even if it means resorting to, violence or other destructive means.
Which is why they express a certain admiration for, I guess you could say, for more radical and authoritarian ideologies like fascism, which they see as offering a more decisive and efficient way to address societal problems.
This fascination with authoritarianism, it is deeply concerning. It suggests this this willingness to sacrifice individual freedoms and rights in exchange for a perceived sense of order and security.
Right.
But it's important to remember that history has shown us time and again that such ideologies, they inevitably lead to tyranny and oppression.
Yeah, it's a dangerous path to go down, and it highlights the importance of defending democratic values and institutions,
yeah.
even when they're imperfect, because the alternatives are they're far worse.
Absolutely, we need to be vigilant, I think, in protecting our freedoms and holding our leaders accountable,
right.
while also working to address the legitimate grievances that that fuel these extremist ideologies.
So it's about finding a balance between acknowledging the flaws in our systems,
right,
and working to improve them without falling into this trap of believing that that a radical overhaul is the only solution.
Exactly, it's about recognizing that that progress is often slow and messy,
right.
But it's worth fighting for.
And speaking of fighting, let's talk about the author's views on gender and relationships. There's a lot of anger,
uh-huh.
and resentment towards women in their writing,
yeah.
often expressed in very misogynistic and violent language.
This misogyny is it's deeply troubling, and it reflects this this worldview that sees women as as objects to be controlled and possessed, rather than as individuals with their own agency and worth.
They use terms like gynocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
Which refers to the belief that society unfairly favors women at the expense of men, and the manosphere, which is this this loose collection of online communities that that promote this idea of male victimhood,
mm-hmm.
and often advocate for a return to traditional gender roles.
These online spaces, they can be echo chambers where harmful stereotypes and conspiracy theories about women are they're amplified and reinforced, leading to this this really distorted view of reality and a justification for for violence and discrimination against women.
It's like they've created their own mythology,
yeah.
about how the world works,
yeah.
and within that mythology, women are the enemy.
And the sense of grievance and victimhood, it can be incredibly dangerous.
Right.
It can lead to this justification of violence and abuse, and it can prevent, men from seeking healthy and fulfilling relationships with women.
Right.
Based on, on mutual respect and equality.
It's a reminder that we need to challenge these harmful ideologies and promote a more nuanced and compassionate understanding of gender and relationships.
Absolutely. And it's not just about protecting women.
Right.
It's about helping, you know, helping men to heal and grow, to develop healthy relationships with themselves and with others, and to find a sense of purpose and belonging that that isn't rooted in anger and resentment.
Okay, so we've explored this author's disillusionment with society, their search for meaning, some of their more troubling and dangerous beliefs. But there's one aspect of their writing that I find particularly fascinating, and that's their views on technology. They seem to have this very complex, ambivalent relationship with it, acknowledging its potential benefits while also expressing, you know, deep concern about its negative consequences.
This ambivalence is it's understandable. Technology has undoubtedly brought about, you know, incredible advancements in so many areas of life.
Right.
But it has also created, you know, new challenges and exacerbated existing inequalities. And I think this author's struggle to reconcile these conflicting aspects of technology is something that, you know, that many of us can relate to.
For example, they'll talk about the potential for automation to lead to mass unemployment, leaving millions of people without a means of supporting themselves.
This is a legitimate concern. As automation technologies continue to advance, we need to consider the economic and social consequences, and you know, and develop strategies to ensure that everyone benefits from these advancements, not just a select few.
But then they'll pivot and talk about things like nanites and chemtrails as examples of how technology can be used for, you know, nefarious purposes, which definitely veers into, I don't know, conspiracy theory territory.
Yes, these claims are, they're often associated with conspiracy theories, and they lack scientific evidence. But it's important to understand, I think, that these fears, while often misplaced, reflect a broader anxiety about the potential for technology to be used in ways that, you know, that undermine individual autonomy and freedom.
It's like they're struggling with this idea that something that has the potential to be so beneficial can also be used for, you know, for harm.
And that's the crux of this thing. Technology is a tool, and like any tool, it can be used for good or for evil.
Right.
And it's our responsibility as individuals and as a society to ensure that, you know, that technology is used ethically and for the benefit of all.
And part of that responsibility, I think, is being able to critically evaluate information and to, you know, separate fact from fiction, especially in an age where misinformation spreads so easily online.
Absolutely. We need to develop our critical thinking skills and become more discerning consumers of information. But we also need to recognize that these anxieties around technology are often rooted in deeper societal issues.
Right.
You know, like economic inequality, political polarization, and a lack of trust in institutions.
So it's not just about technology itself. It's about the context in which it's being developed and deployed, and about addressing the underlying societal issues that make people susceptible to, I don't know, to fear.
And misinformation.
Precisely. And speaking of misinformation, let's talk about the author's observation about communication in the digital age.
Yeah.
They suggest that broader communication leads to emptier communication, which leads to, you know, spasticated attempts at filtration.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
It is.
But I think I get what they're saying. It's like the ease and speed of modern communication has created this paradox where we're constantly bombarded with information, but much of it is, you know, superficial, irrelevant.
And then we have to create these elaborate filters to try to sift through the noise and find something meaningful.
Yes. And this constant filtering and curation, it can lead to these echo chambers where we're only exposed to information that confirms our existing beliefs.
Right.
Further insulating us from, you know, alternative viewpoints and hindering our ability to think critically.
It's like we're building our own little information bubbles. And within those bubbles, it's easy to lose sight of the, I don't know, the bigger picture.
And this is where the author's anxieties about authenticity and meaning come full circle. If we're constantly filtering and curating our experiences, how can we be sure that we're engaging with the world in a genuine and meaningful way?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And I think it's something that all of us are, you know, are grappling with in this digital age. How do we stay informed and connected without getting lost in the, I don't know, in the echo chambers and filter bubbles?
Yeah.
How do we cultivate a sense of authenticity and meaning in a world that's constantly trying to, you know, sell us something?
Those are the million-dollar questions. And I don't think there are any easy answers. But I think it starts with, you know, with recognizing the problem.
Yeah.
And being willing to, you know, to step outside our comfort zones, to engage with diverse perspectives, and to be, I don't know, more critical consumers of information.
And maybe to spend a little less time online.
Yeah.
A little more time engaging with the world around us in a more, I don't know, direct and authentic way.
Excellent point. Sometimes the best way to find meaning is to disconnect from the noise and to, you know, reconnect with the real world.
Yeah.
All right. So we've covered a lot of ground here, but I still feel like we're just, I don't know, we're just scratching the surface of this author's complex and often contradictory worldview.
You're right. There's still much to unpack. And in the next part of our deep dive, we'll explore some of the more nuanced aspects of their thinking, including their views on culture, art, and the future.
All right. Welcome back. We've been on quite a journey with this deep dive. We've explored the author's disillusionment, their search for meaning, some of their, I don't know, troubling beliefs, and their complex relationship with technology. And now I'm kind of curious to see how all of this plays out in their views on, like, culture and art.
Yeah, this is where I think their cynicism takes on this more aesthetic dimension. They seem to have this deep, you know, disdain for what they consider modern art and culture, viewing it as, I don't know, as shallow and meaningless and even degenerate.
Yeah, I remember they made this this snarky comment about Kraft mac and cheese type fucking art. I laughed out loud at that one, even though I'm not sure I fully understand what it means. What do you think they're getting at with that comparison?
Well, it's definitely not a compliment. They seem to be associating modern art with something that's artificial. Mm. Mass-produced, lacking in, I don't know, nutritional value. It's a way of dismissing, I think, an entire artistic movement as something that's both aesthetically and intellectually empty.
So it's not just about personal taste. It's a deeper critique of what they see as this, you know, decline in cultural standards.
Right.
They seem to be longing for a time when art was something, I don't know, more elevated, more meaningful, more, well, less like Kraft mac and cheese.
Exactly. And this this critique of modern art is often tied to, you know, a broader critique of modern society as a whole. They see contemporary culture as a symptom of, I don't know, societal decay, this departure from, you know, traditional values, a sign of moral decline.
Yeah, it's like they're yearning for this, you know, return to a simpler, more authentic time. Although it's worth noting that this this idealized past may not have ever actually existed.
That's an important point. This romanticization of the past is a, you know, it's a common theme in many conservative and traditionalist ideologies. It's a way of, I think, rejecting the, you know, the complexities and uncertainties of the present by clinging to this this imagined past that was somehow, you know, purer and more virtuous.
But, you know, that doesn't mean their critique is entirely without merit. They do make some interesting points about how cultural symbols and narratives can be, you know, co-opted or misinterpreted, mm-hmm. particularly by those they see as, as ideological opponents.
This is a valid observation. The meaning of symbols and narratives can shift over time.
Right.
And they can be used in different ways by different groups. And this author seems to be particularly frustrated by the way certain cultural touchstones have been, in their view, you know, distorted or appropriated by those they see as enemies.
Yeah, it's like they're fighting a cultural war, defending their own interpretation of, you know, history and tradition against those who they believe are trying to rewrite it. And this battle for, I don't know, cultural dominance, it often plays out online, where different groups are competing for, you know, for attention and influence.
And that online battlefield can be it can be a breeding ground for extremism, as we've seen, you know, in the author's own writing, when people feel like their values and beliefs are under attack. They can become, I think, more entrenched in their own views and more hostile towards those who hold different perspectives.
It's a reminder of the importance of, I think, you know, critical thinking,
yeah.
respectful dialogue, even when we're dealing with issues that are, I don't know, emotionally charged or culturally sensitive.
Absolutely. We need to be able to engage with different perspectives without, you know, without resorting to personal attacks or demonizing those who disagree with us.
Okay, let's talk about their views on the future. It's safe to say, I think, they're not exactly optimistic. They seem to believe that that society is on this inevitable path towards, you know, decline and collapse, a vision fueled by their cynicism towards institutions, their anxieties about technology, and their belief in this, I don't know, this pervasive moral decay.
Their pessimism is it's palpable. They paint this rather bleak picture of a future where, technology enslaves humanity, traditional values are eroded, and society descends into chaos and violence. It's a dystopian vision that's both unsettling and strangely compelling.
It's like they're drawn to these, like, apocalyptic scenarios, almost as if they find a, I don't know, a perverse sense of comfort in the inevitability of it all.
It's possible, I think, that this sense of impending doom provides a kind of, I don't know, perverse sense of order in a world that feels increasingly chaotic and unpredictable. If everything is going to collapse anyway, then, then there's no point in trying to fix things.
It's a nihilistic worldview, but it's also a dangerous one.
Yeah.
If you believe that the future is hopeless, then you're less likely to, take action to create positive change.
Exactly. And this passive acceptance of decline can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we don't believe that things can get better, then we're less likely to make the effort to make them better.
So it's important to recognize that the future is not, predetermined.
Right.
We have the power to shape our own destiny, individually and collectively.
Absolutely. And while it's important to acknowledge the challenges we face, it's also crucial to maintain a sense of, I don't know, a sense of hope. An agency. We need to believe that we can create a better future, and we need to be, willing to work towards it.
Okay, we've talked a lot about the content of this author's writing, but I want to circle back to something we touched on earlier, and that's their use of language. They use a lot of profanity, slurs, other offensive language. Why do you think they resort to such such extreme and hateful rhetoric?
The use of offensive language can be this, this complex phenomenon with a variety of motivations. Sometimes it's a way of expressing anger, frustration. Sometimes it's a way of, shocking or provoking others. And sometimes it's a way of signaling belonging to a particular group or ideology. And I think in this case, it seems to be a combination of all three.
They're clearly angry and disillusioned with the world. And they're not afraid to, to express that anger in the most, I don't know, visceral way possible.
Exactly. And the use of of slurs and dehumanizing language, it's particularly concerning. It reveals this deep-seated prejudice and a lack of empathy for those they target.
It's a reminder that words have power and they can be used to inflict, real harm.
Absolutely. We need to I think we need to be mindful of the language we use
Right.
and the potential impact it can have on on others.
They also use a lot of internet slang and meme culture references, which can make their writing, difficult to understand for those who aren't familiar with these online communities.
Yeah, this use of internet slang and memes is a way of, signaling in-group belonging, creating a sense of shared identity with others who are part of this, online subculture. But it can also serve to further alienate those who are, outside of this group, making it more difficult to engage in meaningful dialogue.
It's like they're speaking a different language, one that's only accessible to those who are, already part of the club.
Exactly. And this can create a dangerous echo chamber where extreme views and hateful rhetoric are well, they're amplified and normalized.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. This deep dive has been, I mean, it's been intense.
It has.
It's been like dissecting a complicated puzzle, trying to make sense of the pieces. What are some of the I don't know, the key takeaways you think listeners should keep in mind as they reflect on this author's writing and our conversation?
Well, this deep dive has offered us, I think, this glimpse into a deeply troubled mind grappling with complex social and existential issues. And while we should never condone the author's, hateful rhetoric or extreme views, it's important to recognize that that they are a reflection of, a wider societal
A
malaise.
malaise that many people, especially young people, are feeling right now. The disillusionment, the search for meaning, the anxiety about the future, these are all, very real and very relatable struggles.
Exactly. And while this author has channeled those struggles into this very dark and destructive path, it doesn't mean that everyone who feels this way will do the same. There are healthier and more constructive ways to cope with these feelings, and it's important to reach out for help if you're struggling.
Yeah, it's also a reminder, I think, of the importance of empathy and understanding. Even when we encounter viewpoints that we find, you know, repellent, it's crucial to try to understand where those viewpoints are coming from.
Absolutely. We need to be willing to listen to each other, to engage in, you know, respectful dialogue, and to challenge our own assumptions. Only then can we hope to, I don't know, to bridge the divides that that separate us and build a more just, equitable, and compassionate world.
That's a powerful message to end on. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive. It's been a wild ride.
It has been. Thanks for having me.